The gateway to the West. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Oh, you will not believe some of the topics we're going to talk with investigative mythologist William Henry about in just a moment. And then next hour, we'll also be joined with historian Lawrence Gardner. So there's going to be a mini roundtable discussion just ahead right here on Coast to Coast AM. William Henry is an investigative mythologist and author of 10 books on ancient mythology and neo-archaeology with a Stargate twist. By applying the latest theories in science and consciousness to ancient myths of the gates of the illumined gods, including Sumerian, Egyptian, and Holy Grail gateway myths, he hopes to uncover the secrets of the guarded by such groups as the Illuminati. His latest book, Oracle of the Illuminati, states that we are on the verge of rediscovering the sacred science of creating peace on Earth. Our guest, William Henry. Hey, William, welcome back. How are you?
Terrific, George. Thanks so much for having me back on.
Always a pleasure. What have you been up to over the last couple months since we last chatted?
Well, I've been doing quite a bit of traveling. I had a really wonderful time at the International UFO Expo out there in Laughlin. That was a fantastic event, and been doing other assorted lectures and working on a new book about Atlantis.
Oh, are you? Tell me you have discovered it.
Well, working on it, I'm taking a hard look at the symbolism of Atlantis. We have the tentative title of the book is called The Cross of Atlantis. This is after the famed concentric rings and cross symbol that denoted the capital of Atlantis, and I'm looking at that in light of other gateway symbols and finding some amazing, amazing things.
When's this one due out?
Well, it should be out by the fall.
Okay, good for you. Good for you. Hey, lots to talk with you about this hour. The next hour, we're going to bring Lawrence Gardner in and chat. And then the final hour, of course, we'll open up phone lines to allow all your fans and Coast to Coast listeners an opportunity to chat with you and William about some of the things at hand. You have done just an incredible job, William, over the years of investigating some of these myths, trying to connect the dots where nobody really has been able to. When you go in to do an investigation, what's your blueprint for discovery? I mean, you seem to be able to see the puzzle before anybody's put the pieces together. How do you do that?
Well, it's primarily a process of opening up to, in a sense, synchronicity, I would suppose. I'm not a channeler. I'm looking always for historical resources and then looking for the common links between various traditions. And that seems to be something that a lot of people don't do. They focus on a specific tradition, be it the Sumerian, with the exception of the Egyptian, or they'll go after the Egyptian stories and not really look at the Sumerian or look at maybe even the ancient American. But when we step back and look at this from the perspective that all of human history is essentially one giant mirror, let's say, that long, long ago was shattered, I'm picking up pieces, and where one person might be tempted to say, well, I have this piece here and that's the truth, I'm saying, well, wait a minute, that's a part of the truth. And what we're looking for are the other pieces that remain scattered, and how can we put those together to bring the entire picture together?
Are you convinced now, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the ancients had knowledge, maybe even technology, way beyond what we possess right now?
Well, the artwork that they left us certainly would suggest that, and the symbol system that they left. I think they were really pretty brilliant in that sense, knowing that histories can be lost if it's written in a textbook or if it's written in other texts, but pictures and oral history can stand more the test of time. And so I tend to focus more on those symbols and what they mean, because a symbol seems to be more eternal than even the written word.
You, of course, are familiar with the work of Zachariah Sitchin and, you know, his theories, his interpretation of some of the Sumerian texts. Do you believe in some of his thoughts, William?
Oh, I do, absolutely. And in fact, I know that Zachariah, who is, you know, of course, one of the primary stepping stones for a lot of this research that's been going on, certainly in the past decade. I'm really happy to report that he's out, he's lecturing, he's working on new books. He's still got vibrant ideas that are coming forward. So it's a continuing investigation that he's a part of, and I know that I hope that when I'm in my early 80s, or if in fact he's that old, I'm still doing the incredible work that he's doing.
I tell you, he must have rebounded, because I thought he was getting pretty ill for a while.
He was, and that, again, is the good news, that he's found another source of inspiration and just keeps cranking.
Aha, maybe my theory's correct. Maybe he came from another planet as well. Huh? That's why he knows all this stuff. I was trying to figure out, how does this guy know how to interpret all these ancient texts? That's probably it. He's one of them. He's one of the Anunnaki or something.
There might be more truth to that than you realize.
You know, the when you look at some of the ancient texts, you really come away from it, William, with an understanding that something dramatic was happening on this planet a long time ago. Let's talk about the Sumerians for a moment. You've got some history and knowledge about this. In your opinion, this Anunnaki, this group called Anunnaki, what do you think they were? Where do you think they came from?
Well, from based upon my assimilation of some of Zachariah Sitchin's material, combined with our friend Dr. Michael Heiser, combined with other research even done by Lawrence Gardner, who's going to join us next hour, the Anunnaki are a group of beings. And first of all, Anunnaki is a very general term for any group of beings that came to Earth from the heavens. It's akin to the word angel. It doesn't refer to a specific race, although in Sitchin's reinterpretation of the Sumerian myths, it's claimed that the Anunnaki came from a place called Nibiru, which he proposes is a 12th planet in our solar system. Now, again, Dr. Heiser did such great work in presenting the idea that actually Nibiru is referenced by the Sumerians as the Nibiru. And what the Nibiru is a ferry, a star, a gate, and a crossing place. And when I put those two lines of thought together and combine it with the proliferation of the Sumerian cylinder seals that show this amazing artwork, I come to the conclusion, or the, let's call it a conjecture rather, an operating thesis, that the Nibiru was a stargate, and the Anunnaki are a group of star beings who came through this gateway that at one time was located in ancient Iraq, and perhaps was also located on Mars, and perhaps will be rebuilt or is being rediscovered right now.
And, you know, as wild as that sounds, if we can just approach this with an open mind and assume for a moment that there's so much knowledge out there in the universe that we don't possess, that others might have had because of a jump start of a million years or even a billion years of a civilization someplace, it's probably very possible that they found these stargates, these wormholes, whatever they might be, and they were able to travel these great distances in the universe that way.
Absolutely. I mean, the artwork alone and just focusing on Sumeria and Egypt reveals tremendous knowledge, not just of the macrocosm of space, but also the microcosm. There's a gentleman by the name of Laird Scranton. He has a book called Hidden Meanings, in which he studied the symbols of the Dagon tribe and found that the symbols of the Dagon tribe, who appear to have interacted with beings that are very strikingly similar to the Anunnaki of ancient Iraq, their symbols reveal that they traveled through interstellar doorways. And the symbols that they use to denote these wormholes or stargates are the exact same symbols used today by modern science to present a wormhole.
And didn't this organization of ancients pass on this information in terms of pictures and symbols, as you say, that maybe eventually they'd realize that we would be smart enough to interpret exactly what they were trying to give us?
That's precisely what I think is happening, that we have finally re-evolved, come back around the higher level of the spiral to where we can understand what this artwork is portraying. And what it's portraying is an advanced primordial sacred science that revolves around doorways and gateways into other realms. And that becomes then the central myth of all of humanity. It is the guiding motif in all myth and scripture, no matter which tradition you're talking about. Jesus, for example, said, "I am the door." What did he mean by that? When we talk about the gate at the Garden of Eden, what are we talking about? A simple gate in a patch of real estate in ancient Mesopotamia, or possibly a gateway to the larger garden, the Garden of Galaxies?
Maybe so. This tribe, the Dagon tribe, they knew things that modern astronomy took hundreds of years to learn with modern-day telescopes. How in the heck did they know this stuff unless they were told by someone from above?
Right, and that's the big question right there. It's the Mayans the same way. I mean, they actually describe themselves as star beings and technicians and bridge builders into the galaxy. But we have to ask, where did they get this knowledge? Was it given to them by beings who came from outside of our solar system, or did they find some way of traveling into the solar system themselves in order to develop this advanced cosmology?
I keep hitting my head against the wall sometimes, William, trying to figure out, where did they go? Where's the technology? Where are the ships? And you know what? They probably took everything right through one of these stargates and off they went.
Absolutely. And in fact, what I'm doing now and what I did in my lecture at the International UFO Conference was show that, in fact, the artwork that the Anunnaki left reveals that they were using particle accelerators, advanced particle accelerators for opening holes in space. And when they show their craft, these are actually what NASA now terms a warp drive craft. These are craft that can go through these interstellar doorways. And it's very easy and very incredible, actually, to interpret the artwork of the Anunnaki in light of this stargate symbolism. It's there. It's astounding.
I wonder if modern scientists are looking at some of this artwork and they say, you know what? I think I'm going to design something like this. I mean, it's almost like there's a blueprint there for them.
It really is. And half the time, I'm tempted to just want to start filing patents based on some of this ancient artwork.
You know, go ahead.
Because with a little bit of effort and the right team of physicists, we could really put something together here. But the problem is that the moment, and I've been actually warned against this by people in high levels of science, that the moment we really go public with this, an individual, now he could be considered a terrorist. Because this stuff is so advanced that it would immediately make the person who wants to bring it forward be perceived as possibly a public enemy.
That's possible, too. Now, this stargate that you said ended up in Iraq a long time ago, what happened to it? Did it close up? Where did it go?
Well, a couple of different theories. One, that it's simply destroyed, or two, that it's actually underground. The last reference to it that I've been able to detect, apart from Saddam Hussein's interest in it, was in 600 BC, as recorded in the Book of Daniel on the story of Nebuchadnezzar, when he went into Jerusalem and brought back the wise men from the Temple of Solomon. And in the Book of Daniel, it's clearly described that he and the three wise men from the Temple of Solomon opened a gateway of some kind that is described as a fiery furnace. Three wise men went into this fiery furnace or gateway and came back out with one like the Son of God in tow, or actually the Son of God himself, depending upon which version of the story you read.
Interesting. Now, was this gateway, was it physical or dimensional, if you had to picture it?
I would say everything's dimensional. Everything is frequency. And I think that's why they described it as a fiery furnace, because they're describing a vibrational gateway. It's sort of like being able to tune your radio. At one frequency, you're seeing this reality, but if you had the ability to speed up the frequency or slow it down, you would be experiencing a different reality. And I think in that sense that it's more of an interdimensional doorway.
So were they able to merely just walk right through this doorway, William? I mean, how did they know where it was? Could they see it? Or could they feel it? You know, it sounds like a Twilight Zone episode where this little girl fell out of bed and she fell into another dimension, and her parents woke up hearing her saying, "Where are you, Mommy?" Or, you know, something like that. And they finally realized that she is in another dimension. And, you know, they would, like, reach their hand through the wall and
right.
It would disappear. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what I'm trying to visualize here for this kind of portal or Stargate?
Could be possible. In the particular episode I'm speaking of in the Book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar had constructed a very large device called the Golden Image of the Beast that he was attempting to use, which I would suspect is a form of a particle accelerator that opens these gateways. And he had tried everything to open the gate through this. He tried to use music, he tried to use singing, drums, and only when the three wise men from the Temple of Solomon came along and put on their coat, their hat, and their other garments were they able to actually enter this gateway and then return with the Son of God in tow. And by the way, one of the diagrams that we have there on the coast-to-coast site is of the goddess Mari, or Mary. And she is wearing what I would propose could well be the getup that was worn by these three wise men in the Sumerian world. When Mari put on her coat, it was called her pala garment, or miracle garment. And then she put on a helmet called her Shigura helmet that Sitchin says literally translated means that which makes go far into the universe.
Do you think the clothing had anything to do, though, with what they were able to do? I mean, was it technology all by itself?
Well, I really think, George, that it was actually a spiritual technology, that this is actually creating some form of a sheath that will protect the people, the humans entering this range of frequency or the portal itself. I don't think that we would enter it in human flesh terms. We would have to have, some form of a protective garment of some kind. For example, Mary or Mari's miracle garment, that again, Elijah had one of these. It was called his pala garment as well, and he transmitted it to Elisha. And then Elisha turns up later in the Bible as John the Baptist, and he too has this garment. So based on that, we're either talking about a literal physical garment that can be handed down through the ages, or we're talking about some form of a spiritual teaching that has been being transmitted through the ages. And I think actually it's some form of a spiritual teaching.
Well, there's no question, William, that something happened on this planet a long time ago. I mean, with the work you've done, Lawrence Gardner, Zechariah Sitchin, Michael Cremo with his Forbidden Archaeology.
Amazing.
Something was happening on this planet that merely disappeared. And, no one other than you has been able to explain basically what happened to it. Where did it go? And it makes sense that it just basically disappeared through these portals, through these stargates, or at least we would have found it by now, wouldn't we?
Well, I think that's a very good possibility. In fact, that's when we talk about Atlantis as being a submerged civilization. Oh, sure, there's evidence in the waters off of Florida and off of Japan and elsewhere that attest to some form of a civilization that sunk. But what if, as the artwork that I'm presenting in my new book later this year suggests, that at the center of Atlantis was actually this vortex or this gateway, and that is what ultimately submerged. And when they lost the gateway, that's when we lost our advanced height of civilization. And when we reclaim the gate, that's, as Dr. Michio Kaku says, that's when we become an advanced civilization again.
What's the most fascinating thing, William, that you've unraveled since you've been doing this?
Well, I think it has to be the one remarkable question that I finally was led to ask is, what is the human body? And that sounds like a very simple question, but from the soul's perspective, our body is a ladder or a stairway into the heavens.
I was going to say maybe a time machine. Possible?
Wonderful.
Yep. Stay with us. William Henry, our guest, right here on Coast to Coast AM.
Sign up now for Streamlink, now with podcasting. Get it today at coasttocoastam.com. Somewhere deep below the earth, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Perhaps I'll find my own Stargate when I go back to Los Angeles in a few weeks. After Dark newsletter is being edited in June by our own webmaster, Lex Lonehood, a man of many talents, this is a UFO edition and a collector's item. To subscribe and also get 14 issues for the price of 12, you can do this two ways. Call this toll-free number where operators are there all the time. I think we keep one person there 24 hours a day. Call 1-888-727-5505, 1-888-727-5505. Go online also, coasttocoastam.com. Going through some of my fast blasts, here's one from Kay out of San Francisco. She says, or he says, because who would know with just Kay, I'm having a horrible day today. My sweet German Shepherd had to be put to sleep. Please cheer me up. Well, okay, other than to say that I hope and I am sure you had a great life with your dog. And, you know, they live forever, I guess. They do live forever. And that's one thing to keep you going. Back in a moment. William, you've done some work with regards to the Holy Grail, and there's been an interpretation these days from a number of scholars as to just what the Holy Grail is, and I want to get your take on that, too.
Well, the Bible says it's a cup, but then the Holy Grail tradition says that, in fact, it's a bloodline, that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married, as attested to by classical artwork and documents, which make it plain that they were married and had offspring, and the Grail then is their bloodline. The Grail is also described as a stone that fell from heaven, or the missing capstone to the pyramid. But there's a fourth take on what the Grail is, and that's the one that I primarily subscribe to, and that is the Grail is perceived as a key, a tone, a frequency, or a vibration that when introduced to human blood, cleanses and purifies, in fact, illumines or enlightens the human being. And that's primarily the way I view the Grail, and that's what I'm actually looking for, is that aspect of the teaching.
Is it some kind of electrical pulse generator or something like that?
Well, that's really brilliant, George, because, in fact, as I describe, I have an article on my website, williamhenry.net, called Mary Magdalene and the Lost Secret of the Stairway to Heaven. And in that article, I show a Egyptian depiction of a device that matches something that Zechariah Sitchin says was called the pulser or the emitter by the Sumerians. And this pulser or emitter emitted the living waters of life that brought Inanna, the goddess Inanna, back from the dead.
This pulser, then, this was like a piece of equipment?
As far as I can tell, yes, it's an actual piece of equipment that looks like a rod or an antenna.
Okay, now it wasn't the Ark of the Covenant. That is something else, right? Or possible.
It's actually the pillar that's attached to the Ark of the Covenant.
Ah, okay, which apparently, based on talking to you over the years, the pillar was removed or lost or something, right?
Exactly. It was, and that's when we put the pillar together, which is the pulser, the emitter, with the Ark of the Covenant, we formed this amazing all-purpose technology that can actually open holes in space, that can bring this key of life into our realm, and a whole host of other applications.
So it sounds like the Holy Grail, the Ark of the Covenant, this pulser, these things might have been left behind by these other very high advanced civilizations.
That's the theory that I'm pursuing. Now, of course, Lawrence will also add that the Grail is, in fact, a code of service. And that's a very important component to this, because perhaps not just anybody can operate this technology. We have to be finding a way to operate from a higher spiritual level.
I think it's incredible. If we could ever find the Ark of the Covenant, there are some people that claim they know where it is. I'm not sure, William, but to be able to see this device. Weren't there reports that whoever came in contact with it would die or get electrocuted or something like that?
Oh, absolutely. The Bible is loaded with stories of groups that actually stole the Ark of the Covenant from the Israelites and returned it because it unleashed plagues and what appears to be some form of radiation that killed many thousands of people.
Stargate, time machine, inability to cross great distances in space, maybe that's exactly what this was.
And it's the ultimate secret. It's the ultimate, I believe, creative tool of the ancient gods. Call them aliens, extraterrestrials, interdimensional beings. They possessed this very advanced primordial sacred science that focused on this device.
Based on the ancient texts, were you able to determine how the device worked?
Well, that's what I'm working on right now, and in fact, I'll be going back to Egypt in September with Ivy's Stargate Mystery School, looking for and working with some of the indigenous teachers in Egypt, because I've found new evidence of how this device may have worked as a pulser or emitter of the water of life. And this is something that Lawrence talks about in the Magdalene legacy of Mary Magdalene and her connection to these living waters of life. And it's amazing when we really begin to look at the way in which the ancients knew the secrets of water itself. Christopher Dunn has written about this. So has Stephen Mailer, in terms of how the ancients were able to harness the power of water as an energy source, but ultimately as a method of prolonging life, longevity, and all kinds of amazing things.
The pulser or the emitter, does it need to be attached to the Ark of the Covenant in order to work?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
It absolutely does. And in fact, the interesting thing about this too, George, is that in Egypt, you basically have three classifications of age. You have stuff that's old, you have stuff that's older, and stuff that's really old. And when we start looking for the evidence of this pillar and its existence and usage, we find it in the really, really old stories in ancient Egypt.
William, isn't it Graham Hancock who believes that the Ark of the Covenant is in Ethiopia?
Yes, he does. And in fact, I can't wait for November, because Lawrence Gardner, Graham Hancock, and I will be lecturing together at Dr. Chet Snow's Signs of Destiny conference in Arizona. And this is going to be an amazing opportunity to really lay out some phenomenal evidence. And I can't wait.
And it's also possible, though, if somebody finds the Ark of the Covenant, they may find it without this pulser, right?
Well, it's possible, but I don't know if it's going to be of a whole lot of use, because, in fact, it's described in essence as Aaron's rod of enlightenment. It's definitely one of the accoutrements. For example, imagine the Ark is your computer, but you don't have the mouse that goes with it.
You can't do anything with it.
You can't do anything. Or imagine this computer and you don't have the display,
keyboard.
The screen.
Right.
And that's kind of, in essence, what we're looking at here, is that this is a power system that they utilize to bring energy right, perhaps even out of the ethers. I mean, we're talking about some very advanced science here that then spins off into such applications as anti-gravity, levitation, all that sort of thing. Astounding, astounding stuff.
I rented the DVD National Treasure this weekend.
Yeah.
Great movie. A lot of things that we talk about in Coast to Coast. A lot of things that you've talked about. And by the way, as I was bringing it back to the video store, William, I ran into the devil, but that is for another program. but this National Treasure show, when and I don't want to give it away to people who didn't see the whole thing, but it includes things from the Egyptian days, maybe even way before that, that treasures that were protected over the eons. Do you believe something like that is happening right now, that the Knights Templar or whoever might be out there today is hiding these kinds of treasures from the beginning of time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you talk about, well, just one point of fact that Lawrence puts out in his new book, the fact that Benjamin Franklin went to a Knights Templar commandery to strategize the American Revolution. A Knights Templar commandery located near Rennes-le-Château, France, which was a repository for Templar secrets brought back from Jerusalem. So there's one definite link right there. And then when you look at the manner in which, and speaking of Graham Hancock, he documents this, the way in which Washington, D.C., and as I'm proposing, Nashville, Tennessee, and other cities are being used secretly by the alchemists, the hermeticists, even the Illuminati. They're using the architecture of these cities for mystical purposes, to have an energetic effect, to communicate or transmit their hidden knowledge. And so we see direct evidence that is actually going on today.
What if when they traveled, they were traveling not through space, not in our universe? What if they were going into parallel universes?
Entirely possible. And just imagine how that would completely revolutionize our world if it were proven beyond a doubt that kind of interdimensional parallel universe travel were possible. And again, myth and scripture suggest that that is exactly what is going on, and that's what we're attempting to prepare ourselves for.
How did we lose the interpretation of what all this was a long time ago? It's almost as if at some point civilization stopped knowing about it, and then all of a sudden investigators like you start to try to put the pieces again of the puzzle together. But this huge gap of thousands of years, what happened?
Well, I subscribe to the notion really put forward primarily in the recent years by Dr. Paula Violette that's based on the idea of the precession of the equinoxes, this 26,000-year cosmic journey our sun and solar system make around the galactic center. It appears that we intermittently go through periods of light and darkness. It's perhaps a natural evolutionary cycle. And it's at this moment now where we are completing one of those cycles in 2012 that the quote-unquote light is returning to us, where all of this makes sense again. And it will make sense for perhaps a brief period of time, perhaps the 1,000 years of peace alluded to in the Book of Revelation. Perhaps for the next 1,000 years we'll have access to this. Then we'll scrap all this and start all over again.
You are a believer that there is going to be some kind of enlightenment by the end of 2012, aren't you?
I believe we're already in it, George. I think it's happening all around us, and we're experiencing the shift that's going to enable that to occur, and it's going to completely transform our world, hopefully for the positive.
Will the shift occur right down at the end then of 2012, the complete shift?
Well, I think it's going to be more of a dawning than an actual shift. In other words, when the sun comes up, it doesn't go from just above the horizon to high noon. It travels through the sky. And I think that that's what we're going to be experiencing between now and 2012 and beyond.
Well, I think there's no question that something is happening, and the Mayans were tapped into this, and it's probably because of this knowledge that came from somewhere else.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that the Mayans had a Milky Way-based or a galactic cosmology. They did not identify themselves as Earthlings, as many of us do. They were children of the stars. They were children of the heavens who identified their existence more with what is out there than is down here on Earth. And that's a profound worldview in and of itself.
I'm convinced the people doing Stargate, which is on Sci-Fi, might have heard you on the program over the years.
I don't watch the show, but I have people talk. I have Coast listeners come up to me all the time at conferences and get in touch with me through the website saying, wow, you know, you got to watch this show. This is amazing what they're doing. And it's like, well, you know, it's part of the human quest. It's the ultimate human quest. And it makes sense that it would be represented in one of the most popular television shows worldwide.
I think it is fascinating how television somehow tries to create some of these events that have really occurred with symbolism, like this kind of show, Stargate, which basically echoes a lot of things that you've always talked about.
Absolutely. Another show that I love is Jimmy Neutron, a children's show on Nickelodeon.
Yeah. My granddaughter told me about him.
You ought to check it out sometime. It is absolutely hilarious. I talk about these blue apples that open gateways in space, and there's episodes of Jimmy Neutron where they show precisely that. And I'm like, they've got to be reading my books.
Absolutely. Speaking of your books, you've also got a DVD available, don't you?
Well, my new one is, I've got several. I'm always working on something. I've got a, speaking of the movie National Treasure, I just finished a documentary called A Nation Under God, exploring the signs and symbols of the founding fathers and their connection to the ancient mystery schools. These founding fathers of our country were just flat enlightened beings, no question about it. And when I go through this, I've got hundreds of documentary illustrations in this documentary that just show the astounding inspiration behind the founding of this country.
I think it goes all the way back to the Egyptians, maybe even before that.
I can take it all the way back to the Anunnaki. I mean, it's truly astounding. I was blown away when I started the research on this and said, wait a minute, this goes back even further than we realize. And isn't it interesting that we're in Iraq today digging up the very secrets that the founding fathers would have loved to have known about?
How many people on this planet do you think are really aware of the past knowledge on this planet? And they protect it, they possess it, maybe they even have their own personal libraries of it.
Well, you always talk about, I mean, going back to, say, the 1860s or so, when you had the Rockefellers, you had the J.P. Morgans and such that were trying to get this knowledge. You have Yale University, Harvard, University of Pennsylvania in America. You've got various universities throughout Europe. It's, the number would have to be in the thousands, but they're all kind of bringing pieces together. And it's really difficult to quantify, but I would say that there is definitely the top 1% of the population in this regard really has a clue about what's going on.
Tell us a little bit about your website, williamhenry.net. Of course, you get thousands of hits on that all the time, don't
mm-hmm.
you?
Yeah, and I've got some new articles that are put up there. I mentioned Mary Magdalene and the Lost Secret of the Stairway to Heaven. I've got some DVD specials that I'm really excited about, offering the Stargate 2012 DVD and also my Egypt Stargate Discovery series from last year in Egypt.
How many different speaking engagements do you attend each year?
Between 30 and 40.
Wow. That's a lot. That's a lot of traveling.
It's a ton of traveling, but it's really, it's a tremendous source of inspiration and energy, too, because it's always meeting people that listen to Coast, and they're always coming up to me saying how much they enjoy the show. They listen to you all the time, and it's just a great way to connect. There are so many people out there that are just starving right now for this kind of information, and they know that something astounding is unfolding in our world, and they want to participate in it, and they're wondering, what can I do?
Would you have liked to have been alive during those days, thousands of years ago, William, just as a witness?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I try to tune into that mindset as much as possible when I'm doing the research, and it was probably a very, very different existence from what we have, in the sense that it wasn't as material. It was focused more on the spiritual and a connection to the earth, and largely, I would say, an identification more with again, the out there as opposed to the down here on earth.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to connect with Lawrence Gardner in just a moment, and then we'll have both of you on next hour, and that'll be fun. And just feel free to jump in, William, and we'll all chit-chat together. We'll do it almost as a mini roundtable discussion. William Henry, our guest, his website, williamhenry.net, N-E-T. And I'm not kidding, he gets thousands of hits all the time. So just go on up there. Take a look, by the way, of the incredible artwork that William has on his website as well. It's just simply fascinating. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment now then with William Henry and historian Lawrence Gardner. I think we're going to go to England to pick him up in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
Podcasting, the new way to get Coast to Coast AM to your computer. Available to all StreamLink subscribers at coasttocoastam.com. Yeah.